Something for the weekend, it's Trina Mari here, and inside Making a Murderer 2, the Irish tour is going to be at Vicar Street in Dublin on the 3rd of June, the Opera House on the 4th in Cork, Dolan's in Limerick on the 5th, Galway's Black Box on the 8th of June. And this is all about the TV show I'm sure you're very familiar with on Netflix, Making a Murderer. Brendan Dassey was convicted of murdering photographer Teresa Halbach when he was just 16, alongside his uncle Stephen Avery, who was also convicted. Now, the case was the subject of the Netflix series Making a Murderer, where we saw the real videotapes of their police interviews. Brendan was sentenced to life in prison with the earliest possibility of parole in the year 2048, interrogated on one of those videotapes, and he confessed. And after his conviction, a judge ruled that his confession had been coerced and they overturned his conviction and ordered his release. Now, however, it was later decided that the police had properly obtained his confession. And on the line, we have got Laura Nerider, who is a clinical assistant professor of law and co-director of the Centre on Wrongful Convictions of Youth in Chicago. And Laura represents individuals who were wrongfully convicted of crimes when they were children or teenagers. And Brendan is one of your clients, Laura. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Thanks for taking our call today.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks, Trina.
Yeah. So this is such an interesting case. And I think the Netflix show has really, I mean, anyone who didn't know the case, and particularly in Ireland, we wouldn't have known about this case only for the Netflix show. It's opened our eyes to a lot of things, but still a lot of confusion out there. And a lot of people don't really know, were they guilty, were they innocent? We might just start off by asking you, where are we at now with this case? What is the latest update on it?
Let me start as Brendan's lawyer and as someone who's represented him for 11 and a half years, let me answer the first part of your question. Brendan Dassey is absolutely innocent of the rape and murder of Teresa Halbach. That's something I believe and know down to my bones. His case wound its way through the Wisconsin court system, in which we challenged that confession that the world saw on Making a Murderer and that outraged the world on Making a Murderer. And we fought that case all the way through the United States federal court system, in fact, where we, a few years ago, came within about 12 hours of getting Brendan Dassey out of prison, won a series of victories on his behalf in which courts, after about 10 years, decided to throw out that confession. But those victories, as you noted in your introduction, were blocked at the last minute by the state of Wisconsin. So that's where Making a Murderer Season 2 ends, and we are still representing Brendan Dassey. Steve mm-hmm. Drizin and I, just as we have done, you know, we're not in the business of giving up on our clients, and we are still fighting tooth and nail for Brendan every day. He's still got plenty of legal options left. You know, someone in his position can go back into the state court system and file a post-conviction petition based on newly discovered evidence. And he also has the ability to approach the new governor of Wisconsin and ask for clemency. So plenty of road to travel yet, and plenty of fight left in me, Steve, and importantly, in Brendan.
How does that happen at the very last minute? You thought that he was getting out. I mean, he was packing his bags, a few hours to go. How are they able to change their minds about something like that?
Yeah, exactly. That's a great question. The way this works, there's a usual appeals process, which is what we did. We went through the usual appeals process. We won those appeals. We got the confession thrown out. And we got a court order in which a court said, okay, you've got to let Brendan Dassey out, right? Send him back home. It has been too long. It has been too unjust. We had that court order in hand, and you're right. Brendan was, you know, getting ready to walk out that door. And the state of Wisconsin approached the court system and asked for this very, very rare legal maneuver called an en banc rehearing. It's basically where you throw out the old appeals and redo them in front of the full court. Usually appeals are only heard by three judges, but they said, no, throw it out and let's redo it in front of the full court. This is granted in only one out of every 680 cases, and it was granted in Brendan's case. And of course, when we redid that appeal, as folks saw in Making a Murderer, we lost that appeal by a single vote. So that was what happened to Brendan. 679 other cases, he would be home today.
Talk to me, Laura, about the actual interview process that he went through. So for anybody who may have watched the TV series on Netflix and they just can't remember exactly, you know, the interview process, or anybody who hasn't seen it, what did the police do in the interview process that was incorrect, in your opinion?
Yeah, so Brendan Dassey's interrogations closely resemble the interrogations in hundreds of proven false confession cases. It's very frequently a common set of interrogation tactics that cause false confessions, right? The way that psychological interrogation works is it turns the world on its head. It suddenly makes it make sense to say that you did things that you didn't do. So for Brendan, okay, Brendan was questioned four times over a period of 48 hours. He's 16 years old. He's intellectually limited. He doesn't have a parent in the room for three of those four occasions. And the first time the police question him, he's at his school. It's the middle of the school day. They show up at the school. Mom has no idea. They bring him down to the principal's office, and they tell him out of the blue that the prosecutors are looking at charging him, Brendan, with having something to do with the murder of Teresa Halbach or covering it up, which was a complete lie. There was absolutely no evidence pointing to Brendan Dassey, but in the United States, police are allowed to lie like that during interrogations. Mm-hmm.
Did they know that he had intellectual difficulties?
They say they didn't. You know, in my opinion, anyone who sits with Brendan for about 3 minutes will observe,
you know
that he's not functioning quite at the level of an honor roll student. So they say this to him, and of course that scares Brendan as it would scare any of us. And then they start saying things to him over the course of those four rounds of questioning. Things like, okay, you know, they're looking at charging you, Brendan, but as long as you fill in the blanks of our story, you're going to be all right. Things are going to be okay. You've got nothing to worry about. We'll go to bat for you, over and over and over again. And then, right, once they send this message, all you have to do is fill in the blanks and this threat of charges will go away. Then the part that everybody, I think, will remember from Making a Murderer is when they tell him on videotape exactly how to fill in those blanks, right? This is a kid who's been told that if he confesses to murder, everything's going to be okay for him. So he's trying to describe the murder of Teresa Halbach, right? And he keeps getting it wrong. He's guessing on tape all these different ways he can think of to kill someone, you know, choking, stabbing, punching. Even at one point, he guesses that they cut off her hair to kill her. All of this is incorrect. The forensic evidence is that she was shot in the head. Right. So finally, he guesses and guesses and guesses. He can't come up with the right answer. And on tape, the officers say to him, Brendan, I'm just going to come out and say it. Who shot her in the head? And he says, oh, that was Uncle Stephen. And then in one of the most heartbreaking moments of the entire interview, they say to him, Brendan, why didn't you just tell us that? And he says, because I couldn't think of it. Right. This is a child who is guessing, who's making up a story to please his interrogators because he thinks that everything will be okay so long as he tells them what they want to hear.
Yeah, you see, I know you're saying that, Laura, but if that was me, and I know obviously it's different, he does have intellectual difficulties, but I just don't think I'd admit to doing something I didn't do. Do you get me?
Of course I understand.
Yeah.
This is the big question in all false confession cases. When people hear about this phenomenon, you know, false confessions, why would anyone say they did something, right? Why would anyone say that they did something, especially as heinous as rape and murder, unless they actually did it? This is the big question. And this is the sort of counterintuitive phenomenon of false confessions. In fact, when you start looking at interrogations, you have to remember these messages are sent repeatedly over hours and hours by carefully trained, seasoned professionals who are trained to deploy these psychological techniques in just the right way, in just the right order, over just the right period of time. And they have caused false confessions not only from kids like Brendan with intellectual limitations, but they have also caused false confessions from adults with normal IQs, from honor roll students, from white-collar executives. The annals of false confession cases are filled with everyday individuals because these techniques work. They work too well. They're very, very good at getting true confessions.
I remember the part where Brendan really thought that he was going back to school. Remember, he was worried about getting his project handed in on time.
And exactly, like,
You're not going back to school today, you know?
Twice he asks to go back to school. And even after they say, okay, Brendan, you just confessed to murder, you know, you're not going back to school. You're being placed under arrest. Even then he says, is it only for one day? And why does he say this? Why? It's precisely because of those techniques that we talked about. Because he's told, as long as you say these things, you've got nothing to worry about. It's going to be okay. You'll be all right. We'll take care of you. That's why he thinks he's going back to school. Mm. Because that's what he was meant to think. That's what he needed to think in order to get the confession.
How can we be sure that a confession has been forced? What are the real signs, you know, in your eyes, Laura, that a confession has been forced?
Well, in a case like Brendan's, all you have to do is look at the physical evidence in the case to understand that this confession is false, for one thing, right? The story that Brendan tells, that he ends up agreeing to tell, is, you know, not only not corroborated by the physical evidence, but it's actually disproven by the physical evidence in the case, right? He ends up telling this story where Teresa Halbach, the victim in this case, was shackled to the bed in his uncle's trailer, and this whole sort of scene unfolds with throat cutting and stabbing, hair cutting, and so on, all on this bed. Well, after he tells the story and is placed under arrest, the police went back to Stephen Avery's trailer, right, to look for any evidence that this really sort of incredibly brutal and bloody crime ever happened there. And they looked at that at the bed. They looked at the headboard. They looked at the bedding. They looked at the bed frame. They looked at the mattress. They looked at the carpet underneath the bed. They even pulled the carpet back.
There was no blood.
And looked underneath the carpet, just scrutinizing that room for a single shred, a single molecule of Teresa Halbach's DNA or Brendan Dassey's DNA. And they found nothing. I mean, the story did not happen. Period. It didn't.
Can I ask you, just on, say, lie detectors, the polygraph tests, how accurate are they generally, or are they accurate at all?
Polygraph tests generally are not thought of as particularly reliable indicators of guilt or innocence. You know, some people put more stock in them than others. Some law enforcement officials put more stock in them than others do. But that's something that happened in this case to Brendan by his own attorneys, of course, when his pretrial attorney got involved in the case, Lynn Kaczynski. I don't know if folks remember him from Making a Murderer, this early attorney of Brendan Dassey's who ended up trying to frame his own client. Lynn Kaczynski hired a man to administer a polygraph test to Brendan, all in an attempt to get Brendan to confess again more accurately in a way that made more sense to this crime. And Brendan did undergo a polygraph test that was administered by this man, Michael O'Kelly. Michael O'Kelly then lied to Brendan and told him that he failed it and interrogated him again. His own defense investigator interrogated him again, trying to get him to confess again to this crime. In fact, Brendan passed the polygraph with flying colors. But that's how polygraphs are used most often in the United States, as an interrogation technique. You give somebody a polygraph, you tell them they failed it, whether or not they did, and that sort of jolts them into a position of psychological vulnerability that you then exploit with these tactics.
But it can't be used as evidence in a courtroom.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned there about him having a number of lawyers over the years. Why is that? Why did nobody stick with him?
Well, we've stuck with him for 11 and a half years. But what happened to Brendan at first, right? Brendan was arrested after he confessed. And because his family didn't have a lot of money, he received a court-appointed lawyer named Lynn Kaczynski, right? This is somebody who represented Brendan for free.
Right, so this guy didn't have a clue.
This guy, it was way worse, way worse.
Yeah, okay, right.
He didn't have a clue.
Right, okay.
Believe it or not, he tried to frame his own client, as I said, and a lot of it was actually caught on videotape, the acts that he and his investigator took to try to coerce Brendan into confessing a second time, turn that information over to the police without telling Brendan, all these things that were really outrageous in Making a Murderer. So after all of that was discovered, after it was discovered that Brendan's defender, his defense lawyer, was trying to further frame him, that guy was kicked off the case. And Brendan received new court-appointed lawyers at the time of his trial. Okay. They were only appointed by the court to represent Brendan during his trial.
Mm-hmm.
So once Brendan was convicted, they were no longer available to him. And that's when we at the Center on Wrongful Convictions came in and agreed to represent Brendan pro bono in his appeals ever since.
Okay, that was going to be my next question then. You know, if he's behind bars, who is paying your fees? So you're doing pro bono.
We represent all of our clients pro bono at the center. Yeah, we've exonerated close to 50 individuals over our history. And you're right, when people are locked up, they obviously don't have access to money. And often these injustices hit families hardest, people who don't have means, people who are vulnerable to exploitation.
Yeah.
So we take these cases for free. Nobody's ever paid us a single penny to represent Brendan Dassey.
So what do you do then? How do you get paid?
Our center is a part of Northwestern University in Chicago, so our salaries are paid for by the university. And in terms of the money that we use to investigate cases and do our actual work, all of that is provided by donations.
Interesting stuff. So you're obviously very confident that he is innocent. What about the uncle, Stephen Avery, Laura?
Yeah, so I have a policy, actually, of never commenting on Stephen's case.
Okay.
Not because I have a specific answer to that question, but because he has his own lawyer.
You're not representing him yet.
Yeah, exactly. So just as a matter of professional courtesy, I leave questions about Stephen up to his lawyer.
Okay. And just finally, Laura, last June, I know the Supreme Court rejected the appeal to hear the case. So what do you do now? What's next for you in this?
Next step for us is to keep on fighting. There's still paths to go down for Brendan. There's no doubt about it. We're still working on this case every day. We're still investigating this case every day. We're still working on solutions, on finding a way to walk Brendan Dassey out of those prison doors. You know, we know because of our history in this space, because of our other exonerations, we know that sometimes it can take 10 years, 15 years, 20 years before justice finally sees the light. But it always does. Until justice comes out in this case, you know, I'll be standing next to Brendan Dassey fighting for him.
Do you think the Netflix series has helped you in any way or almost made it a bit more difficult because it's so high profile now?
You know, when Brendan was convicted and for the first 8 years, I was representing him. So before the series ever came out, Brendan was forgotten. Totally forgotten in a prison cell in the middle of rural Wisconsin. You know, if anybody did remember him, I suppose it was as a murderer. And then the series came out. It was so much bigger than any of us ever dreamed.
Yeah. It was the thing that we were all talking about around the water cooler in the office every day. Did you
and
watch the next one? Yeah, isn't it though?
You know,
yeah.
It's incredible stuff. I mean, the way the story has resonated, and you know, within a week of the show coming out in 2015. Brendan started getting letters from people all around the globe, not just people from Wisconsin or the U.S., but Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, the U.K., Europe, South America, Singapore, people who watched the show and felt for him and just wanted to send him a note to say, you know what, I see you. I see what happened to you. Hang in there. Keep your head high. Keep on fighting. I believe in you. And I can't tell you what those letters have done for Brendan. They have given him hope. It sustains him, and it sustains us too.
Yeah, so his mental health, he feels he will be released.
Yes.
He was 16 at the time. He must be 30 by now, is he?
Let me see here. Brendan is 29 years old.
29, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he is.
It's half his life gone nearly already behind bars. Well, listen, Laura, it's been so interesting talking to you. Laura Nereider there. She is going to be here in Ireland for Inside Making a Murderer 2, the Irish tour. And we'll put all the dates. I mentioned them at the beginning of our interview, but I'll put up all the dates on our social media. I'm sure you're going to bring us lots more insights at the shows as well, Laura. So thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Laura. This is Something for the Weekend on Classic Hits.